Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Being a teenage girl is not easy. For author Maureen Stanton, who grew up in Walpole in the 1970s, that time in her life was further complicated by her parents' separation, an addiction to angel dust, and years of delinquent behavior. She chronicles those years and what they taught her in her latest book, Body Leaping Backward, Memoir of a Delinquent Girlhood. These days, Stanton lives in Maine. She teaches creative writing at UMass Lowell. She stopped by our studio today and joins me now to talk about her memoir. Maureen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Maureen, you've said that you avoided writing this book for a long time. Why was that? And why did you do it now?
I really was writing it for really decades, literally, and carrying around files across states that I lived in. And I think it was a moment of shame in my life, and a moment that troubled me. And so I kept pushing it aside. It was hard to face. But in 2014, after my father passed away, I felt like I could bring the story out into the world, or try to. I think that he didn't really know a lot of what we had done, or I had done. And I just didn't—he would have felt really guilty and bad, and I just didn't want that. Yeah. So that kind of liberated me a little bit to go ahead and work on the book.
Aside from writing it to kind of process and tell your own story, was there anyone else or any other, you know, who did you write this for besides yourself, and why?
You know, I really wanted to give voice to a teenage girl, and so I wrote in a very sort of raw, honest way, because teenagers don't necessarily have the psychological development to understand what they're going through or to write their stories. So by proxy, I wanted to be a voice of teenage girls, teenagers who are somewhat troubled or are having a difficult time from the passage from childhood to adulthood for whatever reason. I really wanted that voice to be part of a larger conversation so that we can understand more about girls' lives and what girls go through.
Yeah, I did think that there was this kind of larger resonance. So I was a very young child in the 1970s when this book takes place. I'm the youngest of a family of 9 children, 8 living.
Wow.
You are mm-hmm. one of 7 mm-hmm. children. And there were so many details in the book that to me just reflected the chaos of a big family. Mm-hmm. And yet there were other layers of chaos also happening. Teenagerhood is also chaotic.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
then there were all these other layers of chaos. Your parents separating, your mom is trying to go to school and work. What role did chaos play laced throughout this story?
I think that's a really good way to put it. When I tried to go back and find out why did I make so many bad decisions, it wasn't really one thing. So that's why I tried to layer in some of the cultural stuff of the 1970s, because that certainly factored in some of the family stuff, coming from a big family, a divorced family, mother at work, father, you know, obviously coming over once a week or twice a week, and my own personality, which was outspoken. My mother calls me her most outspoken kid, or maybe big mouth. I don't know how you want to say that. Either way, can be good, can be bad. And so I really tried to have that layered story that kind of got at all of the forces that influence the shaping of a girl, of a consciousness, and the good influences and bad influences.
You know, you talked about your mom used the term big mouth, that you were sort of kind of pushy,
mm-hmm.
right? You said earlier that you wanted to write this book about a teenage girl. You came up in a time where having your own mind was not necessarily celebrated in a young woman. And it sounds, as I read the book, I felt like you were both looking at the hazards of that streak of independence, but also there was something feminist about it. Was I reading that in for myself, or did you intend that?
No, I really intended that. And it's true that girls are sort of shaped to be polite and nice. And if you're a little bit different, a little bit assertive, a little bit of a truth teller, if you're the person that's going to say the thing that everyone's thinking and no one wants to say, then you're going to get pushed down a little bit. If you're too demanding, too grabby, too whatever it was. And this is something that actually has followed me into my adult life and certain jobs, and I've told I'm too assertive and that kind of thing. So, I think in the 70s, during second wave feminism, there was just this two different ideas, like women should be out there, speak out. And I had some of that maybe through osmosis. I knew some of that. But also this sense that, you know, I had lost self-confidence, as many adolescent girls do when they reach puberty. And I just read something recently, an article that said girls still lose confidence when they hit puberty, more so than boys. And it sort of made me sad that we're still dealing with those kinds of things. And part of it is this sense that they're conditioned and socialized to be nice and polite and not necessarily leaders and assertive and risk-taking. And if they're gregarious or outspoken, they're not rewarded in the same way that boys can be.
You know, it hadn't occurred to me just till just now, but you've referred to yourself now as truth-teller, as risk-taking. There's a lot of very personal information in this memoir. I wonder, could you have written it if you weren't a risk taker and a truth teller?
You know, that's interesting because because it was a teenage girl's portrait, I wanted to be as honest as possible. And there are parts of it that are even a little embarrassing to me. But I thought, I really want to get into the heart and mind of a teenager in a very real way. But I think there's always been something about me that is going to blurt out the truth, and then sometimes regret it after, but to be that outspoken person, to be that person that can't help but, I mean, I was always called too critical when I was growing up, but I can always see the, see the thing that should be said. I've had to learn actually how to tame that a little bit as a professional on jobs.
Yeah. Well, one of the dimensions, so there were some really, you said earlier, you know, there are a lot of different causes for who you were and the choices you made as a teenager. One clear theme is that you used a lot of PCP. You became, mm-hmm. I think, arguably addicted to angel dust. And it, as a reader now in a time of the opioid crisis, the parallels seem so important to me and so strong to me. Was that your intention, and how do you see those parallels?
You know, in some ways I didn't intend that because I'd always wanted to tell this story, and it just happened to come now during a time of the opioid crisis. But I think the parallel is that if you're a teenager and you're going to take a risk and you're going to rebel and do something, something sort of disruptive or harmful, you're going to do whatever's around. And so we didn't have opiates in the 70s. We had PCP. It was cheap. It was easy to smoke, easy to use. It was everywhere. And so, like with the opiate crisis, I think that it's just available. It's easily available.
Let's have you read an excerpt from the book. And, you know, you talk about rebelling and let me just let you read it. Go ahead.
Okay. I could have become a burnout, a space cadet, circuits blown, a no mind. I could have died of an overdose 100 times if I hadn't passed out first or run out of drugs or been prevented in some way from ending up in oblivion because I did not know how to stop. I could not stop. When I consider what could have happened, I become momentarily unhinged from my present life, flushed with a loosed anxiety that somehow I might still be in danger or dangerous. If I was that reckless with my life, that capable of stupid, careless decisions, if I was senseless then, I could be senseless now, untuned to the danger signals around me. I feel so narrowly escaped from those terrible fates, as if somehow I passed through an ever-closing portal into my future, stumbled through it, like the polar caves in New Hampshire, which my family visited one year, geological formations turned tacky tourist site, where we barely fit through the lemon squeeze, a narrow passage between rock walls, or the orange crunch, a tunnel-like passage through granite, the opening a small, bright hole to the other side.
So there's a teenager out there listening to this who feels that you're talking about them and to them. And with the wisdom that you've gained through writing this book, what would you say to a teenage girl today who's putting herself at the kind of risk that you're reflecting on in that passage?
I hope that teenage girl would listen, because when I was in my, you know, throes of doing drugs, I wouldn't listen to anybody. But I would say, if you're feeling in any way out of sorts or sad or like you don't fit in, is to ask for help. But what I would also say is the help has to be there, that communities have to have programs to help kids, schools and churches and social, you know, organizations. There has to be programs so that kids can be engaged in a way that excites them and they don't have to go out and do vandalism or drugs to get that kind of thrill.
The other thing that struck me about that passage is it strikes a larger theme in your book of just having adults who weren't paying attention to you. There was so much time unsupervised, alone, unguided. So what advice do you have for families who maybe are struggling with the chaos of everyday life now? What could they do differently so this story isn't theirs?
You know, part of it was the big family. It was easy to slip through the cracks.
I understand.
I was a very good liar. My mother was at work. I think if your parents are working or they're separated, they've got to work together to track all the kids. Especially if you have a big family, it's not so common anymore. I think we know better what to do when parents separate and divorce, but there's a lot of times when the father's not quite as present. 2 days a week visiting time it doesn't seem like enough. But I would say that communities should really, Boston does this very well with some of their at-risk youth, is they have after-school activities. The Boston Police join with the Boys and Girls Clubs, and they engage kids so that they don't have that free time after school, because kids are going to look for thrills, and they can get it either by, breaking windows with rocks or doing drugs, or they can get it through being part of a hip-hop club or dance or music or, sports or anything. That wasn't really available when I was a teenager. If you didn't make the sports team, there was no way to play games.
Before we let you go, anything you can tell us about your next writing project?
I'm working on a collection of essays about very ordinary things, like doing laundry and mowing the lawn, and trying to sort of make those ordinary moments a little bit strange.
We're going to look forward to that. That's author Maureen Stanton, who also teaches creative writing at UMass Lowell. Thanks so much for joining us, Maureen.
Thank you so much.
Maureen will be talking about her new memoir, Body Leaping Backward, tonight at An Unlikely Story in Plainville. You can find more information about that at radioboston.org. That's our show for today. We're produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.